Welcome to a special edition of the Marketplace Roundtable podcast featuring Jay Mintzmyer of Value Investor's Edge. Jay first began contributing to Seeking Alpha in 2011, building up a large following through his work covering shipping stocks, probably about as comprehensively as they're covered anywhere online or in print. Since 2015, Jay has run the Value Investor's Edge Marketplace service here at Seeking Alpha. The service offers intensive coverage of deep value opportunities in the shipping, energy, MLP, and industrial sectors. You can subscribe to Value Investor's Edge by going to seekingalpha.com and typing Jay Mintzmyer, that's Mintzmyer, or Value Investor's Edge into the search bar at the top of the site. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. Seeking Alpha is a website where authors from around the world share their ideas and analysis on the stock market. The Marketplace is our platform for authors to run investing analysis and idea services so that readers can take their investing to the next level. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. And now your host, Jay Mintzmyer.
Good morning, everyone. Good afternoon, if you're joining us from Europe. We're hosting another iteration of Value Investor's Edge Live, recording on the morning of 9 June 2021 at about 10 a.m. Eastern Time. We're hosting Euronav, specifically CEO Hugo De Stoop, who will join us today to talk about the crude tanker markets. Also talk a little bit about some of the upcoming potential regulations and the ESG focus and how Euronav can participate in that. So we're excited to host him and learn a little bit more about the sector and the upcoming catalyst. Hugo, welcome. Thanks for joining us.
Hey, Jay. Very happy to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Yeah, absolutely. We definitely want to hear from Euronav as a sector leader. And before we get started, I should remind folks nothing here today constitutes investment advice or recommendations of any form. Also not official company guidance. We're just kind of sharing our outlooks on the sector and just having a conversation about the markets. Hugo, again, welcome. We'll start off with the big picture question here. What is the current state of the crude tanker markets? Just big picture, right? We've been over a roller coaster the last year. Are we past that bottoming out, or is there still more pain and some volatility ahead?
Well, I think we passed the bottom, but we are very much stuck a little bit in the bottom. When you see the rates, they're very, very low. They've not been that low for as far as I remember. But obviously, when you look at the reasons why they're so low, there's good reasons to believe that they will improve over time. So, you know, market is cyclical. We are at the bottom and we don't feel good about it, but we have good reason to feel good about the future.
Yeah, well, you know, Euronav has a significant cash balance and a conservative balance sheet, so I'm sure you're fine, even if it does take a little bit longer. What's kind of the target or the optimistic outlook for when rates will become, you know, cash flow positive and earnings positive again?
I think at Euronav, we are very prudent whenever we're being asked questions of when is it going to improve, and we can pinpoint to some indicators that will tell us the market will improve. Where are we at the moment? We have a reduced consumption of crude oil, and that's due to COVID. People not traveling. I mean, some parts of the world are recovering. Some parts are very much still in the crisis. We've seen ups and downs. But nevertheless, when you look at the crude oil consumption, we are still missing about 5 million barrels per day. And 5 million barrels per day is about 5%. And when you look at the shipping demand, that's quite a lot. So those barrels do not exist. On top of that, the OPEC has decided to cut their production, and that's because the demand wasn't there anyway to meet their previous production, pre-COVID production. And then on top of that, we have not seen pretty much any ships. So about 10 ships have been scrapped so far this year, but we were expecting many more ships to be scrapped, and I think we're going to discuss a little bit later why is that. And why we don't believe that it's a permanent feature. But so you have a problem in the demand for your services, which is very much linked to the consumption of crude oil. But you also have a problem on the supply side because there are too many ships. So you need to address those two things. And there are obviously good reason to believe that we're not going to stay permanently the COVID crisis. So when people will start traveling again and when countries will open, reopen, lift all restrictions, we believe that people will go back to the life that they had before the crisis, and that will lift significantly the demand for crude oil and therefore we will be able to provide all services to those missing barrels as well. As far as the oversupply of the vessels are concerned, we believe that's very much linked to the Iranian sanctions, but I do believe that we're going to discuss that later.
Yeah, I'm glad you kind of pivoted there because, yeah, I did want to ask about Iran. I know we shared some notes earlier. How does this deal impact the market for crude tankers? I know initially the oil markets, you know, reacted downward, but even the oil markets look pretty healthy now. So what does this mean for tankers?
Overall, it's positive. And the reason why it's positive is probably even threefold. I mean, first of all, we've been there, right? And the Obama sanctions were being lifted. The Iranian had a similar size fleet that they have today, and they were targeting a similar type of production, which is about 2 million barrels per day of production and therefore export of that production. What we know from the past is that vessels that have been standstill, and most of the Iranian fleet has not been able to move for the last 2-3 years are very, very difficult to bring back to the international markets. They don't have vettings, they don't have permits, they don't have classification society report, they don't have even the crew have not been on board for a long time, and therefore they need to be retrained, they need to be recertified, etc., etc. So what we know from the last time that this does take about 6 to 9 months before you even see the first vessels coming back to the market. And then the fleet is very much a mixed fleet. You have an older part, which is unlikely to come back at all because it's too old, so it will continue to be used as storage. And storage very specific to the Iranian production because they don't have a lot of storage onshore. And then the more modern part of the fleet is likely to come back, but over 9 months. So that deals with the fleet and the production. But then, of course, the elephant in the room is what's taking place right now. And right now, what we see that despite the fact that Iran is under severe sanctions, there are a lot of ships, and some brokers have identified as much as 8% of the VLCC fleet and 5% of the Suezmax fleet that are trading those sanctioned barrels in an illicit way. And those vessels are very old. So those are typically the vessels that we would have expected seeing scrapped or recycled in the last 6 to 12 months, but potentially 18 months. But in fact, they were sold to people who have put up a scheme to avoid the sanction to be able to trade mostly between Iran and China. So those ships will no longer have a reason to exist because the minute the sanctions are lifted, then people will prefer to trade those barrels on very safe ships, very modern ships, ships being operated by decent operators that don't have to hide away like the ones do at the moment. So again, you have more barrels coming to the market, a fleet that exists but is unlikely to hit the market immediately, and a fleet that is trading the illicit barrels, which is likely to disappear because they have no longer a reason to exist.
Yeah, that's a lot of color, Hugo. I really appreciate that rundown. I think that's useful for folks. So, you know, one of the aggravations, I think, of investors and tankers is that we have this beautiful supply picture, right? And you've covered it over the years, right? We had a small order book and we had a lot of vessels that were hitting their 17 and a half surveys, the 20-year surveys, the 22 and a halves. We had IMO 2020 regulations in there. We have pending, you know, environmental regulations in 23 and beyond. And yet there's no demolitions and we're starting to see orders. So I think Iran might take care of the demolition problem. But let's talk about the order book issue. So what's the order book look like today? Does it concern you at all?
The order book doesn't concern me for a couple of reasons. I mean, first of all, it is still around 10%, a little bit less than 10% of the VLCC, a little bit less than 7% on the Suezmax. And from a historical perspective, that's very low. I mean, usually those order books are around 15%. They cover 2.5 to 3 years, which is normal because the typical lifetime of a ship is 20 years. So it's normal that if you have an order book over the next 3 years, you have around 15% of the fleet on order. This is not the case today. On top of that, it's true that we haven't seen scrapping, But it's also true that those vessels who have not been scrapped are not getting younger. It's not like if you were retrofitting them or reconverting them into a younger ship. So whatever they have done, and as I mentioned in the earlier questions, we believe that a lot of them are linked to illicit trading with the Iranian barrels. They're getting older, and therefore they are more likely to be scrapped at some point in time. If it wasn't 20 years old, then it's going to be 21 or 22 years old. So we believe that that will be the, just to come back on the order book. So 10% is totally manageable, and quite frankly, it's going to be very difficult to have an order book with more than 10%. Why is that? Simply, when you look at the other sectors which are competing for berth, for basically space in the yards where we typically build our ships, be it VLCCs or Suezmax, the other shipping sectors have done so well that they've had a lot of orders to the order book. So yes, there are still some slots available for, 24 and some to 25, but the other sectors have already completed quite a lot of those slots. And so it's not like if we could tomorrow see an order and seeing again 40 or 50 ships per year being delivered. So the fact that the order book is in check, I would say, and is being sort of blocked by the other sectors means that we are unlikely to see an oversupply order book like we've seen in previous years or even in previous cycles. Those vessels will be delivered. They will be delivered all the time and not in a concentrated way. And that's also good for our markets.
Yeah, that's certainly helpful to look at it in that perspective. I just to make sure that I heard you correctly, you're basically saying the order book is basically completely done for 2023. If somebody orders a Suezmax or a VLCC today, they're looking at 2024. Is that right?
Absolutely, and 24, there are already some berths which have been booked also by tankers, so definitely by container vessels, by dry bulkers, by gas carrier, and guess what? We're still waiting for a 100 ships order by the Qataris on the gas side, on the LNG side. Those ships will be built in the same shipyards where we're building VLCCs. We've been talking about that order for a number of months, and that's because it's organized as a tender and will be allocated among the different shipyards. If and when that one happen, and we have good reasons to believe that it will happen before the end of the year, then you are talking indeed very few slots available in 24 and not that many available in 25. And so you have, I would say, perfect. A picture of what's coming in against, and I must repeat that, against a very aging fleet, which will be a scrapped or recycled, whatever you prefer to use, because not only will they become too old, but on top of that, those are heavy consumers, and everybody in our sectors is looking at emissions, which is linked with the consumption of the vessels. So that's an additional pressure point that we're seeing in an additional reason why all the vessels will be recycled.
Yeah, it certainly it makes sense that there's a lot of headwinds for some of these older vessels. And it is good to see that the order book is, even though there were some headlines, I think there's headlines that the order book had increased a lot. It was because they were saying, right, it was from 6% to 9 or 10%. So folks were saying, well, the order book's nearly doubled, but it was maybe a little misleading there. There's been a lot of talk about environmental regulations, and I mean, there needs to be a lot of focus on this. And, how are these proposals going to impact Euronav, and what are you doing specifically? As a company to address the upcoming 2023 regulations, as well as just overall environmental concerns.
It's a fundamental question because obviously it will affect our business, it will affect the shipping industry in general. And I think that you have two ways to position yourself. And at Euronav, we've decided to position ourselves at the forefront because we have reason to believe that those regulations will be stricter than what people think and will come sooner than what people think. Let me explain that to you. A lot of people around the world and a growing number of people in shipping believe that a carbon tax is essential for the energy transition and to decarbonize the world. I think that we're going to see more and more people, i.e., countries, companies, even private individuals committing to zero carbon emission by 2050, and that will be probably committed before or at the Glasgow conference, which is coming up in November this year. Ahead of that, we are seeing climate summit organized by President Biden, which is clearly showing a U-turn of the US and a rejoining of the efforts towards decarbonization. Ahead of that, we are seeing a number of countries committing to zero carbon emissions by 2050. Ahead of that, we're seeing a lot of corporate and including some shipping companies. And whereas shipping was not included in Paris Agreement, the IMO has already decided to be part of it. They decided to be part of it in 2018. And now they're putting in place the necessary regulations to make sure that we commit to a reduction of our emissions in order to be in line with the ambition of the Paris Agreement. As a matter of fact, we might very well find ourselves in a situation where instead of a 50% reduction between now and 2050, people commit to 100% reduction between now and 2050. That's where we believe that the regulations will be stricter than what people think at the moment. And therefore, what are we doing at Euronav? Well, you may have seen that the last order we placed in the shipyard were very much focused on what can we do to have one day ships that are being propelled on zero emission fuel. So at the moment, those ships are not available. We continue to use heavy fuel oil, be it LSFO or HSFO, but we know that the same type of engines, i.e. the internal combustion engine, will need to be tweaked, will need to be retrofitted into engines that can burn a fuel like ammonia, which is just a carrier of hydrogen, or any other type of fuel that can be produced and burned, not emitting any carbon, or at least on a net basis, not emitting any carbon, and that could be methanol. So we're busy setting that with the yards, with the engine manufacturer, with the people who will produce those fuels, because let's not forget that there is a little bit of a chicken and the egg problem. I mean, you can be ready with the engine, that doesn't mean you're ready with the fuel. The fuel exist. But a lot of people are now starting to work together, and that's very much the first time that we see in shipping. And normally shipping is very sort of individualistic. People mind their own business, et cetera, et cetera. And now we see a number of coalition being formed among the people. We certainly are very close to some shipyards. They are extremely busy trying to study and trying to develop those zero emission fuel vessels together with the engine manufacturer. And I think that it's very important to be at the forefront, because we want to be amongst the first one to be able to offer to our customers the transportation of their crude oil with zero emission fuel. And as a matter of fact, 6 months ago, I would say that it would be almost impossible to have a conversation with a customer that would say, "Oh, I'm interested." They were all interested in decrease the footprint, but not interested in zero emission fuel, which is normal because, let's not forget, we are in the oil business. Today, we see more and more customers coming to us and asking, when do you think you're going to be ready with that type of vessel? And that's why I believe that we need to be at the forefront. I always compare that to double hull, single hull. So in 2010, we had a regulation that was going to phase out completely the single hull ships. And that was first in 2015. Then it was brought forward to 2010. And then there was an oil spill in Korea, the Hebei Spirit, in 2007. And as 2007, nobody wanted to have or to use single hull. And guess what? Euronav had decided at that time to be fully double hull as of 2005. And so we were one of the few companies that was fully equipped with a fleet of double hulls, and we benefited from that. And I think that it's going to be very similar on this change of the regulatory framework here, and that if you are an early adopters, you will benefit more than the others.
Yeah, I mean, you certainly want to keep both eyes open and take a pragmatic approach to it. I know with scrubbers, for example, that was a huge investment item into 2020, but you took a more cautious perspective, right? You didn't pile into scrubbers, you did some hedging. But it sounds like with the environmental regulations, you're fully on board and you're making a lot more of a proactive move here. You've mentioned a couple different investments. One of them is coating the vessels with a new type of paint. Is this what sort of economics do you get off that? Does that pay for itself just in economics, or is it more so of an environmental signaling type initiative?
Well, let me be clear, just in case I wasn't. Any type of investment we make will follow economic analysis. The reason why we didn't invest into the scrubber is because at that time we had no ships on order at the yards. If we would have had ships on order at the yard, they would have been equipped with scrubbers because the cost was 1.5 to 1.8 million, still the same today. And then the return on investment was pretty obvious. The retrofit of a vessel to equip it with a scrubber was anywhere in the 4.5 to 5.5 million. So before you get your money back, and I can tell you that if we had made this investment, we would still be out of the money today. So very happy so far not to have made this kind of investment. It was for an economic point of view that we didn't do it, and it's true that we also had questions around the environment, the impact that it could have, and therefore the regulatory side and whether it would be allowed or tolerated by the people, by the countries around the world. And you've seen that in most countries they have banned those scrubbers, so you can only employ them in the ocean, and that does tell you something about it. It's a bit strange that people say, "Yeah, you can use it anywhere you want, but not in my water." Right? Well, I will close the parentheses there. But from the economic point of view, we weren't convinced, and we continue to have doubts about it, even though the spread is 110, 120 at this moment in time. Last year, the spread was on average 50 to 60, and you've seen that our performance was identical to the ones of our peers, and that's because we have invested heavily in another direction, which was saving fuel, so not consuming as much as the others. And we have invested in software, we invested in hardware like the paint you're mentioning here. That sort of paint can make you save 7 to 8% of the fuel that you would consume in normal time. And so yes, there is a direct return on that investment. We calculate that it's a year or less. Why a year or less? Because there is volatility in the price of the fuel that you use. So if it's $500 or $600, then obviously it goes very quick. If it's only $300, like we saw in some months last year, then it's a little bit slower. But overall, it's between 6 months and 18 months that you get your money back. And it's always the basic principle that we will apply at Euronav. If we start investing in ammonia ships, for instance, it's because we will have good reason to believe that we can hire or rent those ships or charter them out to people who will pay a premium to be able to transport their oil, minimizing the carbon footprint. So we're not doing that for the environment on its own. We're not a charity. We're not philanthropic. We are a business. Everything we do is for an economic reason, and we believe that the direction we're taking on the environmental front makes a lot of sense from a business perspective.
Yeah, I think that's a really helpful clarification, Hugo. I mean, it's clear that you've done a lot of analysis on this, and you've made the decision that from a business perspective and an economics perspective, shareholder return perspective, it only makes sense, right, to be ahead of the curve on this sort of thing, and the economics make sense. A couple follow-ups on that, and these are quicker questions, but it sounds like on scrubbers, retrofits are probably still off the table. Is that correct, even with the larger spreads?
At the moment, yes, we have two ships which could hit the sweet spot, i.e., right age profile, having a dry dock early next year, so still ahead of time to order it. So we're making the analysis, and that's also to demonstrate that we are absolutely not dogmatic about it. Something that we do month after month, we discuss with the team, and also we discuss the possibility of hedging the spread to make sure we get the return that we want. But so far, no decision has been made. Having said that, and you probably know it, we do have four VLCCs that have been delivered a new building earlier this year. They're all equipped with scrubbers. The two Suezmax that we have bought as a resale in the yard that will be delivered early next year are equipped with the scrubbers, and the other VLCCs that we have ordered, which will be delivered in 23, are also equipped with scrubbers. So you can see that whenever it's a new building, as I said, it's a no-brainer. The cost is obviously a little bit more than for standard new building, but you can justify that because you don't need a spread much bigger than $50, $60 to justify that cost.
Yeah, it certainly makes sense. The economics are different. There's another little bit of a niche question, but I've seen a little bit of focus on these hull paints. There's been a little bit more of an environmental focus on the older paints that use copper oxide. Has that been something you've looked at all from an environmental standpoint, or is that not really a factor yet for shipping?
Well, I think as a business, you always have to take into account what is the impact that you make on the environment. And again, this is always coming from an economic perspective. You don't want to have a bad reputation. You certainly don't want to have to pay fines to clean up your mess, et cetera, et cetera. So the type of paint that we apply have followed a lot of studies, which tends to believe that they don't have a negative impact on the environment. And yet they have a very and here I'm talking about the sea environment, and yet they have a very good impact on the air environment because they allow our ships to emit far less CO2. As I said, the consumption can decrease by anywhere between 7 and 8 or even 9%, depending on the type of ships and the shape of the hull, etc. And that's why we are repainting existing hulls. So it's obvious that when it's a new building, we order them with that type of paint when they're coming from the yard. But for existing ship, we are also using that paint when we go to dry dock. We anyway have to repaint the vessels, but they cost more money. The analysis tends to demonstrate that you get your money back within a year or 18 months at the worst, sorry.
Yeah, it's really hard to argue with that payback period. Pretty impressive. One last question on the environmental side of things. I've noticed, obviously, your recent acquisitions have all been resales or new builds with the latest specs and scrubbers and some ammonia-ready stuff on the latest. You also have a handful of older vessels. And, you know, I was curious, first of all, are those going to satisfy the 2023 EEXI requirements? And second of all, when you go to demolish those vessels or sell them, do you have to be concerned about like a green certificate or something like that? There's a concern, right, that you could sell it to another company and the other company might do something irresponsible with it. How does Euronav address that with the older vessels?
So two or three questions in that one. So the first one is we do have some older vessels, but you will have seen that we have taken some actions. And by the way, the age profile is not always in tune with the type of consumption. So a 15-year-old vessel can consume more than a 18 or 19-year-old vessel. So they might not have the same EXI or carbon intensity. So we obviously pay a lot of attention to that. You know that we have, for instance, 8 what we call the N-class. Those are 8 VLCC that were built in China. And those are also 8 VLCC that we sold and take them back on charter as a bareboat. But at the end of the lease, there is no purchase obligation, which means that the residual risk linked to those vessels is already handled. So that's already presenting a type of phase out that will deal with those vessels. We have other vessels. We just recently announced yesterday that we were, or the day before yesterday, that we sold our oldest Suezmax. There are other Suezmax that will go. So that addresses your first question. It's obvious that we do take that into account. The vessels that we will have in a fleet in 23 will be able to meet the EEXI requirement. If they are not, then it's a question of derating them. So let me give you another example. We have four VLCCs that have been built at STX. They are very economical when they go at super high speed, like 16 knots. At the moment, we are doing 12, 12 and a half, or even lower, certainly on the ballast. And so they're not so economical. The thing that we can do is derating them. And then from a derating perspective, that's how you meet the requirement on EXI. It doesn't matter for those vessels because they will still be able to do the speed that our customers ask us to do, which is, as I said, between 12 and a half or 13. So you really have to go case by case throughout your fleet, in through each and every vessel that you own, and see what is the likely scenario for the rest of their life. And that's what we're doing at Euronav. The second part of your question was about, okay, when you sell a vessel, are you responsible to what the new owner is going to do with her? And clearly the answer is no. But that doesn't mean you don't have to do a number of things at the time of sale and obviously before selling the vessel. What are those things? Well, Euronav has had what we call the green passport on all its vessels since 2010, if I'm not mistaken. What is that passport telling you? The passport is telling you every single part that has been, that has bought the vessels, be it from inception, that is from the yard, or be it any spares that you put on board, or even any chemical product that you are using in your machinery. So we have a very good inventory of that. It's continuously maintained. And since this year, because of the European regulations that we have adopted on a voluntary basis, we also have an inventory of hazardous goods, which means that when the vessel will be recycled, people know exactly what they have to deal with and how to deal with it if you select the right shipyards to demolish your vessel. Now, we cannot force the vessel, the new owner, to maintain the green passport, to maintain the inventory of the hazardous goods. We cannot force him to go to what we would call a yard already respecting the Hong Kong Convention, which is unfortunately not yet in place, but which is a very good set of rules that shipyards who are specialized in the recycling of ships have to follow. So that we cannot be responsible for, but we are trying, we do make sure that we give all the material that we have collected over the lifetime of the ship to the new owner, and we hope that he will make good use of that. The last point about selling your ship to third party, it is true that we do scrutinize, and we from time to time refuse to sell ships to some people, especially nowadays, but that's much more people that are involved in illicit trading, like we discussed earlier in this conversation with Iran, because you don't want to be accused of receiving money that have been generated by people who are not following the rules. And that goes a little bit the same with the recycling of vessels. You know, if we sell to someone where we know that the minute after he has purchased the vessel, he will go to one of those lousy shipyards on a beach in Bangladesh and try to pocket the difference between the good yards and bad yards, we will not sell to them. So we are putting in our memorandum of agreement that they have to trade the vessel and not scrap it. And I believe that it's at least for 1 year. So that's an additional measure that we are taking. But above and beyond that, it's very, very difficult to do more.
I think those are very, you know, useful measures that you're taking, very clear cut. It's just an area of focus, right, going forward. And it seems like as more and more regulations are developed on green recycling and that sort of thing, that the responsibility for the vessel will, you know, go further and further back. And right now it sounds like it's only about 1 year or 2 years of tail risk, but I guess there's some concern from some investors, logically, I think, that in the future it might be some sort of 5-year obligation or something like that. So that the strongest regulation right now, as you mentioned, or agreement, is the Hong Kong Convention, right? And so the 1 year kind of trading thing, that's just voluntary that you do at Euronav?
It's absolutely voluntary. Now, I hear what you're saying, that maybe in the future is going to be a longer period of sort of shared liability. But let's be honest, that's impossible, right? mean, you cannot sell something to someone and be responsible for what it does with after the events. We can accept, you know, sort of a buffer period. As I said, I mean, perfect example is that you sell to someone who's going to pay you a little bit more than someone else because you know that it's going to go to a bad yard, which has lower cost and can offer you more money. So instead of you yourself going to those bad yards, you're asking someone on your behalf to do it. That's the obvious case where we should be liable. But if things like that happen, you know, 6 months down the road, the guy has done two or three voyages, suddenly the market is not as good as when he purchased vessels from you and decide to go to the wrong shipyard, what can you do about it? How can you possibly be liable for that? You would have put in the agreement that he shouldn't do it, but if he does do it, you're not going to be the party suing him because you have no damages yourself. And so even if you're suing him and you were winning the trial, you wouldn't get any money because you haven't suffered any bad damages because of that. So I think that, you know, it's a little bit, I heard it before that in the future, people will be liable for much longer period of time. I think that it's really impossible to put it in place. And whether we like it or not, that those are factual.
Yeah, certainly good to have the discussion at least and understand what the circumstances are. But yeah, what you said is definitely logical. I just know there's a lot of environmental regulations coming down the pike, and I know that's been one of the focus items. It sounds like most of the focus is going to be, you know, rightly so, right, on greenhouse gas emissions and climate change more so than demolitions. But I know that is a focus item. Let's pivot a little bit here in our last 10 minutes or so and talk about Euronav specifically, your balance sheet, target leverage, and what are those capital allocation priorities going forward? Should we expect more ship resales like you've been doing? Are there going to be any more new builds, any secondary tonnage, any sort of share repurchases? What are kind of your priorities right now?
You know, when we discuss return capital or capital allocation, it's always a little bit of a tricky one because it depends on the opportunities that you see in the market. It depends on how well the market is doing, and at the moment it's not doing very well. It depends on where your balance sheet is, etc., etc. And I think that as far as Euronav is concerned, the only advice I can give to the investors is to look at the past and expect more of the same in the future. So when the times are good, I think we are very generous with our investors. In fact, I was checking that the other day with Brian Gallagher, our head of investor relation. No other tanker company, since we IPO'd in New York in 2015, no other tanker company has distributed more dividends and has done more share buyback than Euronav. And I think that's because we care a lot about our shareholders. We don't issue shares below NAV because that's dilutive for existing shareholders. It's very good for the next shareholder, but not for the existing one. Never done that. I think that we have always timed our acquisition, be it small acquisition or big acquisition. And I think that we have a long-term perspective in a market that is very difficult to call in the long term, except for those few items that are often linked to regulations. And so I think that we have navigated those markets relatively well in the past. We hope that we will continue to be as good in the future. But don't expect anything revolutionary. I think that we're a good steward of capital. When you're a good steward of capital, you're always looking at what you're doing on a daily basis, on a monthly basis, on a yearly basis. And you will change things here and there according to the view that you have on the market, according to new regulations that are coming up, and according especially to the opportunities that you see in the market. You know, the VLCCs that we have ordered, that we announced earlier, when you look at the delivery window and when you look at the features that we will equip those vessels with, people were surprised because it was new building and we hadn't done new building for a long, long time. But I think that it was the most reasonable and the most attractive investment we could make at that time. Today, people for similar vessels will probably have to pay $100 million and get the delivery of those vessels only in 24. So in a year, you can make a lot of money but also you can invest in the wrong type of asset. So we're forward leaning and we hope to continue what we've done in the past, but don't expect us to do anything revolutionary, even if things are changing fast and therefore we have adapted faster than ever in our market.
All right, Hugo, makes sense, but basically, you know, if I can sum that up, it's basically it depends, right? You're gonna see what's available and act on that.
You know what the ingredients are. So leverage 50%, a little bit above, a little bit under, depending on where you are in the cycle. But don't expect us to lever the company to 70 or 80% like some of our peers. Dividends, we understand it's important for our shareholders, so we do have a minimum dividend policy, and we're not going to take that away. When the times are good, obviously we will look at dividends, but also share buyback, as we've demonstrated last year. And that's very much depending on where your share price is trading. And we've been frustrated with the share price for the last probably 18 or even 24 months. You know, it's true that we have been the most generous company. I think that we have had one of the best performance in terms of operation, and yet the share price is lagging. And we are a bit frustrated about it because I think we could do a lot more if we had a share price that was trading at NAV. We could continue the game of consolidation in the market, which at the moment is a little bit paralyzed. But we will see. So yes, it depends, but you do have guidelines. You do have historical track record that tells you what we do according to where we are in the cycle and what are the events that are happening around us.
Yeah, that's certainly helpful. And of course, we like to see dividends, big dividends, when the times are good. And we like to see repurchases, ideally large repurchases, when the times are bad, right? Because that's when you can take advantage of these stock price dislocations. You know, one thing I've heard from a lot of investors, especially in the United States, especially more retail investors, is the impact, and it's not a factor now because your dividends are really small, but it was a big factor last year when you had the large dividends, is the very annoying tax withholding due to the Belgian, you know, headquarters and all that sort of thing. Has that been something you've looked into at all as a company? Because all your peers are headquartered in areas that don't have that tax withholding problem.
That's a very good question. And I would encourage people to come to our website because Belgium is not that big of a country, and they do have a lot of double tax treaty. With matter of fact, it's the country in the world that has the most double tax treaty in the world. What does that mean? It means that you can claim your tax back if you have paid it, or if we paid it on your behalf. But more importantly, and depending on the size of the investment that you've made in Euronav, you can totally avoid having us paying it on your behalf. That's very clearly mentioned on the website. I know it's a little bit different than in other companies, but it does not take a lot of time and effort. And we are here to help if we can help you avoid paying a tax in Belgium and then paying a tax in the US, which can be very frustrating. So the only thing I can tell you is that we've put a lot of information on the website. We realized that it was a problem. We've tried to help. Many investors came to us. We have received many more forms that you need to fill than prior years, especially at the time when those dividends were important. And that's the best way to help our investors indeed.
Yeah, I'm certainly appreciative that you have the resources out there. You know, the big problem with investors on the United States front is almost all the brokerages are very incompetent when it comes to processing, you know, taxation. So they automatically apply, you know, the maximum possible highest foreign tax withholding on all dividends. And then they fight you tooth and nail when you try to work through the taxation with them. So it's not so much the actual legal framework of the taxation. There's this weird technicality that prohibits a lot of US retail investors from efficiently investing in your own app. I realize there's ways around it, but it can be kind of a mess for a lot of folks. So it's just something to be aware of. And if there's any other alternative structures in the future, that would be something to look into.
No, it's certainly something that we have on the radar. And, you know, it's funny you mentioned that at this point, because the G7, G20 that is upcoming have very much looked at those tax havens. And all the other shipping companies are incorporated into those tax havens. And there's been a lot of articles talking about it and the impact that it will have on shipping. So before we would make a move outside Belgium and go to one of those jurisdictions, I think that we need to have a little bit more clarity on what's gonna happen to those fiscal paradise. And yeah, I wouldn't bet that the future is there, if you see what I mean.
Yeah, it's certainly worth noting, right? It's a risk I would suppose for some of those other companies perhaps. A couple quick questions as we wrap up here, just kind of niche questions, but you have those two very large, or I guess ultra large ULCC carriers, 3 million barrel capacity. You had one of them that was in storage trading, and you had another one that you're using to hedge VLSFO. What's the plans for those two vessels now?
So we still have 100,000 tons of fuel oil on board the Oceania, and we continue to perform the program that we've performed. That's probably one of the reasons why our TC is not that bad compared to the peers, despite the fact that there is a spread in the LSFO, HSFO. We buy it in bulk, we get a big discount, and so we can beat the retail price. So that one is still busy on that program, and now we need to evaluate whether we extend the program to other owners or whether we minimize the program only for ourselves. And in that case, the vessel will probably be too large for us. So until the end of the year, I would say that the vessel will be busy as we are asking ourselves the question on whether to grow it or to decrease it. And the Europe was on charter indeed, onto an oil trader. It was redelivered, if I'm not mistaken, 2 weeks ago, and we are in discussion to recharter it out to someone else. Those ships look old because they are close to 20 years of age, but let's remember that they've been built for 40 years. So if we want, they still have quite a longer lifetime ahead of them. But obviously, that depends on the type of employment we will find. They are very interesting vessels. As a matter of fact, not at all comparable to VLCCs or Suezmax, and they haven't been used for trading oil, transporting oil from A to B. But I think that the capacity is unique, and so I wouldn't be surprised if we were to find alternative employment for them.
Yeah, well, we're certainly hopeful. They're interesting assets. And then related to those, you have the two FSOs that are in the joint venture with Euronav. Is International Seaways kind of had a weird clause in one of their takeover agreements with Diamond S that mentioned a potential sale of that FSO joint venture. Is that something that you're considering potentially buying out to be on your own, or you're considering maybe divesting to private equity, or what's kind of the status of that joint venture?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's funny because from time to time, analysts and journalists, they pick up something that you've written a footnote. We had exactly the same clause when we did the Generate merger. So in case we were selling the vessels, there was a special dividend for Euronav shareholders until the closing with the Generate shareholders. That's typically the kind of clause that you see when you do a merger and there is an item on which you cannot agree the valuation of. And I suspect, I wasn't part of the conversation, but I suspect they had similar conversation than the ones we had with Generate. So it's a standard clause that has been sort of put in the spotlight, maybe for no reason. We are not interested in buying the 50% that we don't own. I don't think that INSW is interested in buying the 50% that they don't own. We're very good partners. We've been in that business together and in the pool, as you know, for what, close to 20 years in the pool and in that joint venture, 12, 13 years. So happy where we are. It is true that as a manager, it is your duty to always try to extract the best value for your shareholders. And so if someone was offering us some prices to sell out the assets, including the contract, because obviously it's the contract that is very valuable for those assets. And we would believe that we could do something better with that money for our investors, then obviously they would go and we would reinvest that money into something that is probably closer to our core business. Whether that possibility exists or not, it's very hard to tell. It's a very complex file anyway, because you need the agreement of the client. who's been used to receive a superior quality of service for the last 12 years, and they don't know if other people can do that, et cetera, et cetera. So at the moment, it's a lot of hot air just because of that paragraph that was read by an analyst, and then everybody started talking about it. But today, there's nothing that is very concrete. However, we do our own diligence, and we do look out in the market to see what is the real value of it and whether people would be interested in buying it. But that was the case also three years ago when we renewed only for 5 years.
Yeah, certainly makes sense, Hugo. I appreciate you diving into that because, yeah, we spent a decent amount of time, looking into that joint venture over the years, and it's very profitable, right? And a lot of times when we see it listed in other research reports, there's not a very good valuation ascribed to it. So I can certainly understand where there would be disagreement in some sort of merger or something like that. So that sounds logical to me. Last question for you, Hugo, as we close out our call today. There's a lot of oil tanker companies. There's a lot of crude tanker companies, product tanker companies. Why should investors focus on Euronav? What do you offer that is superior to your peers?
Well, obviously, that's my opinion. I always have the impression to do a sales speech, but I do believe that we have superior shareholders' focus. As I mentioned, if you go back to the U.S. listing in 2015 and you look at what we have done compared to the others, we have distributed more dividends and we have done more share buyback than any other. I would dare to say, potentially, maybe if you combine the others, you still don't arrive to what we have done. So we are very, very close to our shareholders, very focused on them. I think that we also have a clear and differentiated focus on sustainability. At the moment, it's not generating earnings or hard earnings that can be transformed in dividends. But let's not forget that when you're talking about those topics, as I mentioned earlier, the race is very long and you need to be completely prepared for not only the regulations that you know is going to come, but also from the fact that the world is moving faster. I think that I gave you the example of single hull, double hull, where we benefited hugely on those last 3 years before the deadline that was 2010, as we were the only one that had the double hull fleet only. And I would bet with you that it's going to be the same. So you have to bear with us. I know it's unusual for a tanker company to make a little bit longer term investment than what we've done in the past. But I'm sure that it will. We will bear the rewards very clearly. And then the last one is not a point that I particularly enjoy saying, but it's a fact at the moment. Today we are trading at a discount to our NAV and at a discount to where our peers are trading. And so I think it's a very good entry point from this point in the cycle. Also, discount on NAV, low part of the cycle, things are probably at the bottom and the outlook is positive, as we explained in the first part of the conversation. So all in all, it seems to me like if you want to invest in the tanker sector, then now is the time and Euronav is the place.
All right, Hugo. Well, you certainly practiced the sales pitch. It was well delivered. So thanks for that. Thanks for joining us today, Hugo. It was very, very informative.
Well, thank you very much for having us.
This concludes another iteration of Value Investor's Edge Live. We just hosted Euronav CEO Hugo De Stoop to talk about the crude tanker markets and overall outlook for the industry. As a reminder, nothing on the conference call today constitutes official company guidance or investment recommendations of any form. This is recorded on the morning of 9 June 2021, about 10 a.m. Eastern Time.